The High Frontier, a new documentary about Gerard K. O'Neill, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Is his name new to you? As a fan of space exploration and development, it shouldn't be. Like Jeff Bezos and many other luminaries, space entrepreneur and investor Dylan Taylor considers himself one of Jerry's kids. Dylan is executive producer of The High Frontier, the untold story of Gerard K. O'Neill, premiering on April 17th. I've seen it, and I'm thrilled to welcome Dylan, producer Will Henry, and director Ryan Stewart to our show. Move over, Bruce, the Planetary Society's chief scientist, and I will welcome the winning bidder for the chance to join us in this week's What's Up segment. She is a delight, as you'll hear. Oh well, an anomaly cropped up during final prep for Sunday's flight of the Mars helicopter, Ingenuity. That first hover has now been delayed a few more days, but the little whirly bird is said to be in fine shape. The April 9 edition of the Downlink shares some good news. The Europa Clipper spacecraft has passed its critical design review. This means assembly and testing can move forward, with the additional recent announcement that it won't have to be launched by a giant space launch system rocket. The probe could now head for the ocean moon of Jupiter as soon as 2024. And did you know that there are 10 people on the International Space Station as I prepare this week's show? Probably a good thing that it won't stay that crowded for long. Imagine the line for the cupola or the bathroom.
He was like Steve Jobs before Steve Jobs. It was just a feeling of the future had arrived and we can be part of it.
When you create that kind of an image of the future for people, then it's like a blueprint.
The episode of human life being confined to Earth is coming to an end.
Industries and colonies in space may sound incredible, but we who are working toward them know that most of the building blocks are already in place.
You've seen a whole generation inspired by this idea that it is bigger than us.
And it's this generation's job to build that road to space.
And we should do it now.
It's a revolution into which we can all throw ourselves and all of our energies with full hearts.
That's a trailer for The High Frontier, the untold story of Gerard K. O'Neill. You're about to hear Dylan Taylor call O'Neill the father of new space, the new era of commercial space development that is most prominently represented by SpaceX, though there are many other success stories. Dylan himself represents one of those stories. He is chairman and CEO of Voyager Space Holdings and has been an early-stage investor in many emerging space ventures. He also writes about this new age and founded Space for Humanity, a nonprofit organization that wants to democratize space exploration and use space to solve problems we face down here. It's no wonder Dylan now considers himself one of Jerry's kids. That's Jerry with a G, as in Gerard K. O'Neill. I discovered O'Neill and his brilliant, groundbreaking work nearly 45 years ago. He wrote his seminal book, The High Frontier, in 1976. In it, he and his associates laid out ambitious plans for a space settlement, a city in space, probably at L5, one of the Lagrange points, where gravity is almost perfectly balanced and spacecraft can remain indefinitely. Decades later, O'Neill's work continues to inspire and drive many leaders of space development. It troubled Dylan and other fans that O'Neill isn't better appreciated, so he and several talented filmmakers have created this moving documentary about Jerry. It premieres April 17th, after which it'll be available from many sources. I recently connected with Dylan, producer Will Henry, and director Ryan Stewart for the conversation you're about to hear. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me on Planetary Radio, and thank you for this long overdue and very inspiring film. Welcome to the show, Dylan, Will, and Ryan.
Thank you. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
I have been a fan of Gerard K. O'Neill since I bought, way back in 1977, a copy of the brilliant NASA study called Space Settlements that built on Jerry's work and that he was part of, that he contributed to. That led me to his book, which is what inspired the at least the title of your film, if not the entire film. The book was The High Frontier, Human Colonies in Space. I've been a fan ever since. But being a fan of Jerry's seems to apply to pretty much everyone else heard in your terrific film. And that's quite a crowd of amazing men and women. Dylan, I'm going to start with you. How did you first learn about Jerry O'Neill?
Oh, boy. Thinking back, it was probably conversations with some of the luminaries in the industry, specifically Frank White, Rick Tomlinson. I also became curious hearing a little bit of the lore behind Jeff Bezos' valedictorian speech in high school and his journey to Princeton. So I think it was probably all of those things circulating in my mind, probably, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago when I really started getting deep into Jerry's legacy.
Do you now consider yourself one of Jerry's kids, even if you weren't one of those who was lucky enough to work directly for him?
Yeah, I think so. It, you know, maybe one of Jerry's grandkids, perhaps, because you know, I'm not super young, but I am more connected to people who were inspired by Jerry. And of course, I never met Jerry. In making the film, I had the honor to get to know the family, which has just been a joy. But yeah, I would say second generation Jerry's kid is probably the best way to describe it.
One of the things that struck me, which had not before, is that in watching the film, I saw so many parallels to co-founder of the Planetary Society, Carl Sagan. Both of them brilliant, both very charismatic, both cared deeply about public understanding of science, and they suffered among their peers because of their public outreach efforts, and both of them taken from us far too soon. Do you see all that?
Indeed. No, I see it. I see it exactly the way you described it. And maybe just to punctuate that point, a little known fact we cover it in the film is Jerry really should have and probably would have won the Nobel Prize in Physics, but for two instances. One is the, you know, heaven forbid, moniker of science popularizer, which you're alluding to. And the second, of course, is you have to be alive to win the Nobel Prize. But he legitimately would have. He is the inventor, little known fact, but important fact, the inventor of the particle accelerator, which if you look at all the innovations in physics of the last 40 or 50 years, many, many of which are high energy physics, which are derivative of particle accelerators. We have Freeman Dyson in the film. Thank goodness we were able to get Freeman on the film before he sadly passed. And he insisted, by the way, of being on camera, insisted because he loved Jerry. Freeman's one of those gentlemen. He worked with Albert Einstein. He's been around the smartest people on planet Earth. And his affection for Jerry and his respect for Jerry, I think, really comes through in the film. But I think that's a testament to the type of impact Jerry had. But yeah, back to your original point, I do see parallels with Carl Sagan, no question about it.
Should we think of Jerry O'Neill as the father of the commercial space era, what some people call new space?
In my mind, Matt, yes, for a couple of reasons. One is he was the first original new space entrepreneur pivoting from sort of science fiction, science speculation, to forming his own business. You know, sadly, the business didn't turn out the way he expected it to. We cover that in the film as well. It had a bit to do with his illness. But he was sort of the original Branson, Bezos, Elon, if you will. But he was also a communicator, an inspirer, you know, of the highest order. So I think if you look at the legacy of the people in the industry today and you say, how did they get inspired by space? I think two-thirds, if not more, would directly trace their inspiration to Jerry or Jerry's disciples. So yeah, I would say he was seminal in this movement, no question.
You do a great job of documenting this in the film. How his approach to thinking about humans living in space, settlements by humans in space, cities in space, it encompassed so much more than the science and the engineering. I mean, he considered the cultural and artistic and political and certainly the economic aspects because they were going to have to be self-sustaining in so many ways. I'm so impressed with his comprehensive approach to this massive question of figuring out how were we going to make humans, not just spacefaring, but space living, a space living species.
Again, I think if you look at what he left as his legacy in terms of the written word and his plans and the Space Studies Institute and things of that nature, it all holds together incredibly well. It's incredibly thoughtful. It's grounded in science. It's grounded in physics. It's ambitious, to be sure, but it's not, you know, it's not just wild speculation. He actually has a blueprint. And if, you know, back to Bezos again, so the story goes, in his high school valedictorian speech, he had just read The High Frontier, the book, and basically said, look, I've read this book. I'm going to implement it. I'm going to go make a bunch of money in some industry. I'm not sure how. And then I'm going to circle back and implement this book. And of course, that's pretty much what he is doing or has done.
We mentioned Jerry's widow, Tasha, who's heard quite a bit in the film, but the whole family is in there. In fact, you were invited into Tasha's home, what was her and Jerry's home. What was the reaction from the family when you first approached them with this idea of creating a film to honor him and spread his ideas?
Yeah, I'll start with the response on that, Matt, and really credit to Will for really building a deep relationship with the family. They love Will. They love Ryan. They love the people involved with the film. I don't recall. I think it might have been Frank White that connected me originally with Tasha. One of the most wonderful humans I've had the pleasure to meet. When we told her what our project was and why we were doing it, she couldn't have been more generous, providing unbelievable access to materials. I mean, Matt, just by way of example, Jerry had an unpublished autobiography that no one knew existed that Tasha shared with us, really just for context on what was going through Jerry's mind. Family photos, family film, camcorder footage, access to all the family members. Oftentimes we would run ideas by Tasha. We would run possible interviewees by Tasha to get her reaction. Tasha honored Jeff Bezos at a dinner and was able to sort of prime him on the film. Jeff and Blue Origin later signed off on the footage that we used in the film. So it all really tied together. I mean, this film would not have been made without Tasha O'Neill. She's a remarkable woman. If you haven't had a chance to get to know her, I highly recommend it. She's a joy. She really is.
Will, you want to add to that?
Yeah, there's so much to add, really. I think, and I just have to say again, this movie would not have happened without Tasha O'Neill and her generosity and everything that she helped us through along the way of finding these little nuggets of diamonds that we would find about Jerry's life and these little things that people have never seen before. I think people will be astounded. I feel like everyone thinks they have all these little bits that people haven't seen about Jerry, but once they see the movie, they'll see that we had them all. and the way it really kind of played out was that we were initially linked with Tasha, obviously. She started sending me some old footage, some old images, and that's when I saw her address and realized we were neighbors. And I called her that night. We talked about Princeton, I think, for 6 hours, which is where we both were living at the time. But what we followed that up with was reaching out to each family member and saying, hey, you know, we're doing this movie, and there was a little bit of convincing of like, would you also send us some stuff? We'd love to include it in this piece that will be the legacy piece for Jerry O'Neill. And it took time. It took years to really gain the trust of everybody. And it was not the intention to ultimately bring them all back together. I know at the beginning, that's not something they wanted to do. I mean, if it was about my family, I'm not sure I would have either. Over the time of creating the film and building the relationships and realizing just how cosmic and perfect the people making the movie to do the story were the perfect people to do it, they realized, you know what, let's do this. Let's all get back together and talk about Jerry, talk about what it was like growing up with him. It took us a long time to get there, but it was entirely worth it.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, they contribute so much at the personal level to the film, talking about him.
Right.
What drew me in initially as a kid, when I first started to learn about Jerry, you know, Gerard K. O'Neill, it was the illustrations. It was the beautiful artwork, the artist concepts of these ideas that he had worked out from an engineering and scientific standpoint that were made so real by artists like Don Davis, who appears in the film. And I was also amazed and awfully pleased to see in your interview with Don Davis, he actually said that he contacted Jerry and said, how can I help? I would have thought it would have gone the other way.
Yeah, that's kind of the theme of the whole film, really, is that artists and people from all different communities could just come to him and he would just open his arms and let them share their ideas. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't he be thrilled today with the technology we have now for digital art and exploring 3D fly-throughs of your concepts, which is one of the reasons why we pushed hard to do the opening sequence in the film, building that Jerry O'Neill settlement fly-through. He would have loved to have seen that.
This is one of the things that is I'm most grateful for in the film, because you took those illustrations that I and so many other people are familiar with, and you made them, you brought them alive, and you took us inside them. Was that part of the plan right from the start of making the film?
Definitely. All of us definitely knew that the art was a big part of Jerry's vision and how he expressed it to everybody. And it still is. You see his work in cartoons from Japan and all over the place in random places where maybe they don't even know where it originated from.
As the finance guy, Matt, I might slightly disagree. I think we suffered from some scope creep over the course of the film, but you know, it was a labor of love, and everything that we did in post-production, and there was a lot, was in the spirit of how do we honor Jerry and how do we enhance? We knew we had a great film. We wanted it to be a marvelous film. And so we wanted to put all these other additional items on it to really make it a significant film that people could watch 30 years from today and look at it and say, wow, not only is that a well-made film, it honors Jerry. And so we put our effort into it. But yeah, it was a labor of love, and it was actually also quite expensive to make. I won't tell you what it cost.
Thanks for opening the wallet to make it happen. Will, now that we've whetted everyone's appetites for the film, if not the book, how can they see it?
Sure. So we will be having a live premiere on spacechannel.com. That will be on April 17th, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We will then be releasing the film online the following day. That will be on Amazon. That will be on Google, Microsoft, iTunes, and Vudu. We will also be having a special edition, The High Frontier, which is pretty much like the movie version of the book. It'll have some unique info about the movie on it as well. So we'll have that on our site. We have a website that you can go visit, which is thehighfrontiermovie.com.
And we will put a link on this week's episode page at planetary.org/radio. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for making this film happen. It is a delight, and I highly recommend it. And as you heard, even if you are hearing this after April 17th, those of you, many of you in our radio audience, you still have plenty of opportunities to see the film we've been talking about, which is The High Frontier, The Untold Story of Gerard K. O'Neill. Dylan, Will, Ryan, thank you very much for being on Planetary Radio.
Thank you so much.
Executive producer Dylan Taylor, producer Will Henry, and director Ryan Stewart of the new documentary, The High Frontier. I wish we had time to share more of the interview, including our mentions of Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, Laurie Garver, and many others who were seen in the film. You can hear it all at planetary.org/radio. Bruce and our special What's Up guest are seconds away. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, I'm Kate from the Planetary Society. For all its troubles, 2020 has still seen some terrific space accomplishments. We asked our members and supporters to vote for their 2020 favorites. You can see the results at planetary.org/best of 2020. We're talking about the best solar system image, the most exciting moment in planetary science, and much more. That's planetary.org/best of 2020. Happy holidays from the Planetary Society.
Hi, I'm Jason Davis, Editorial Director for the Planetary Society. Did you know there are more than 20 planetary science missions exploring our solar system? That means a lot of news happens in any given week. Here's how to keep up with it all. The Downlink is our new roundup of planetary exploration headlines. It connects you to the details when you want to dive deeper. From Mercury to interstellar space, we'll catch you up on what you might have missed. That's the Downlink, every Friday at planetary.org.
Time again for What's Up on Planetary Radio. We are graced once again by the presence of the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. That is Bruce Betts. And Bruce, welcome. I think you have a special guest to welcome as well.
I do. We welcome Jewel Cry, who supported the Planetary Society through our recent auction and has won the privilege to be on our Planetary Radio. And Jewel is an orchestra teacher, and we welcome her and thank her. Hi, Jewel.
Hello. Thank you for having me, guys. I'm super excited to be here. I'm an orchestra teacher at Andrus High School in El Paso, Texas, and it is just such a joy to be able to do this with you guys. I've been listening to the Planetary Radio for at least a year. I started during COVID, and to just be here and see you guys and do this is super great.
Well, we're excited to have you.
And you're in your orchestra room. Wait, it's what, lunchtime there?
Yes, it is. I'm here in my orchestra room. So this is my classroom where I teach. I have my chocolate milk and chicken sandwich from the cafeteria. I've got it right here.
Well, there are planets. They're still there. We've got Mars getting lower in the southwest in the early evening, looking reddish, also still getting dimmer as it gets farther from us, but forming a nice triangle in the sky with similarly reddish Aldebaran and Taurus and very bright Betelgeuse in Orion. And on the 16th, so a couple days after this comes out, the moon will be hanging out with the three of them, looking quite lovely. Pre-dawn, getting higher up, easier to see in the east, very bright Jupiter and yellowish Saturn to its upper right. Let's move on to this week in space history. We had Apollo 13 in 1970, fortunately made it back and landed on Earth this week. And 2 years later, Apollo 16 launched and landed on the moon. And 3 years ago, in 2018, the TESS spacecraft launched, TESS, the exoplanet-hunting spacecraft that you just did an interview a couple weeks ago about.
Indeed. We're ready to move on now to that portion of the show that I think, Jewel, if you could maybe get Bruce to deliver for us.
Bruce, I would be absolutely pleased to ask you for a random space fact, please.
She even rolls her R's.
Very nice. Okay, I'll even give you one that's sort of personal. All right, it's not that personal. as Ingenuity, the little helicopter, attempts the first controlled powered flight on another planet, that is, if you don't count sky cranes, we recall the little-remembered NASA Mars Airplane Program. Late 1999, NASA Administrator mandated effort to fly a Mars airplane for the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' first flight in December 2003. You all remember the Mars airplane, right? Langley was chosen to lead the effort, and the esteemed Dr. Bruce Betts was chosen as the NASA program scientist.
That's super cool.
Oh, and then it was canceled after about a year because they never gave it nearly enough funding. But a lot of talented people worked on it, and it resurfaced as a finalist in a Mars Scout selection, but obviously was never selected. So there you go. Mars airplane, weird trivia.
Sorry that didn't happen. Such a cool project. Let's go on to the contest.
I asked you to name all the people who flew in space while serving in the U.S. Congress. So sitting senators and representatives. How'd we do, Matt?
I will let our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild in Kansas, answer this one for us. Jake Garn went to space in 1985, flew aboard the shuttle with its booster hyperdrive. Not really. Next year, Nelson went from Florida with success. Both were listed on the crew as payload specialists. John Glenn also flew in 1998. He became the oldest man to fly in space to date. So three, we see, have been to space of note. Must have made it fun for them when casting Senate votes.
Nice rhymes.
That's wonderful.
Senator Jake Garn and Senator John Glenn and Representative Bill Nelson, currently in consideration for NASA Administrator.
Just nominated by Joe Biden. Here's our winner. My goodness, he first, as far as I can tell, entered the contest 7 years ago, more than 7 years ago. This is his first win. Ian Jackson, congratulations. He's in Germany. Ian, we're going to send you a copy of the Backyard Astronomer's Field Guide, How to Find the Best Objects the Night Sky Has to Offer. It's by David Dickinson. fine little book about exploring the night sky. Bruce, I think we're ready for another one.
Keeping the theme, what was the first successful flight on another planet? That would be besides Earth. Successful flight, here are the necessary caveats. It's going to be obviously an unpowered flight, and do not count parachutes or heat shields or other things designed primarily to land on a surface. So first successful flight on another planet. Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Jewel, you want to take a stab at it?
No.
Good, because you ruined my contest.
Well, I don't want to be wrong on planetary radio. That'd be terrible.
We do it all the time.
Yeah, it's a regular thing for us. Jewel, you can enter if you get that entry to us by April 21st at 8 a.m. Pacific time. Here is the prize. I can show it to the two of you because you've got video. This is from a professor, Henrik Hargitay. He has developed, look at that. What does it look like? It looks like one of those cute travel atlases you can get for some portion of Earth, right? Except it's for Mars, and it is beautifully illustrated. Professor Hargitay has offered these. We're going to offer several of these over the next few weeks. Now, the reason this is going to come directly from Professor Hargitay is that he will enclose for you, if he knows where you live, and he will because he's going to mail it to you, look at this little overlay he gave me with the state of California. It is done to scale so that you could put it over the maps in the book and compare it to, you know, the scale of something that you know well. It is just the coolest little book. And I will note that it was published in cooperation with the European Science Foundation in Strasbourg. So that's it, the Mars Pocket Atlas. It could be yours if you win this time around. Bruce, I think we're done other than thanking Jewel for joining us today and for her support.
Thank you again, Jewel, and everybody go out there, look up the night sky and think about, I don't know. What do you think, Jewel?
Why don't you guys think about any senators, representatives you'd like to send up to space and back?
Thank you, and good night.
Kind of you to give them a round trip, Jewel, and since that was nonpartisan, we'll make sure that is a part of this week's What's Up with the Chief Scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts, and Jewel Cry, the winner of the auction that allowed her to join us on this week's What's Up. Jewel, where were the bells? All I heard was a door slamming.
I actually don't know, and I'm wondering if maybe there's testing this afternoon that I didn't know about, and I need to check my schedule to make sure I'm not supposed to be overseeing it like last week. Yeah, that's actually really strange.
Finally. See, I knew there was a reason we had to hang out. That wasn't much of a bell. Do you know what note? You're an orchestra teacher. Do you know what note that was?
It is a slightly out of tune B flat. I'm not sure if that's how it comes across on your end, but when we're tuning, so orchestra instruments tune to a 440 hertz A. So when that's on and we're tuning, it sounds horrendous.
Best close maybe ever for a What's Up segment. Thank you, Jewel Cry, for joining us. And thank you, Bruce.
Thank you for having me. This is an absolute blast.
Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its inspired members. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.